Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. It was a week in which we learned once more that expertise matters, a week in which we learned that credibility still counts, and a week in which the script was truly flipped, with lives upended and pretty much all affected by coronavirus. Schools closed, sports events and concerts called off, and telecommuting a new reality. People are reporting anxiety as well as the desire for a common will to pull through, and so many questions. One listener, Maureen from Virginia, tells us her husband is a maintenance worker at a small college that will probably have to close down for now. They have few savings.
My husband's in the most vulnerable group for the coronavirus. He's over 65 and has health issues. Both our daughters have autoimmune disease, and the youngest is in a COVID-19 hotspot and has insurance through us. The eldest is aged out of our insurance and cannot afford to buy her own. The stock market crash has depleted his retirement in 401k, so that he can probably never retire now.
We start today in Boston with Rick Burke. He's co-founder and executive editor of Stat News, which covers health, medicine, and science, and it's been on the case on the COVID-19 story. Rick, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, David. I'm here alone in the office, practically. There are three of us. I came in to talk to you, and then I'll probably go home. Are you sitting there alone, or are many of your colleagues there?
No, we've got a couple of folks here in the studio here in Chelsea, in the neighborhood of Manhattan. They've come in. I'll say a word about that toward the end of the show. But, people are doing what they have to do to keep the show on. And at the same time, people are, taking great precautions. I'm glad you guys are as well.
Right.
Rick, let's talk for a moment about what Maureen had to say. You can't address all of her fears and concerns, but I'm sure there are a lot of people listening and a lot of people around the country who feel just that way. What do you say to them?
I think all you can do is follow the news, take your own personal precautions, stay inside, don't put yourself at risk in any way, and that's all you can do. No one has any magic solution or bullet, or certainly not a vaccine. So all we can do is stay safe and protect ourselves and protect other people.
You and I met when you were a political reporter a lot of years ago, but you've been doing this now for some years, overseeing a really, for people who don't know about Stat News, it's really a rather extraordinary site of expertise and information. And I believe I'm not mistaken in saying you guys have put all your content about coronavirus outside the paywall so the public can come to it as a resource. Is that right?
That's right, David. We first started covering this early January, and we immediately put it in front of the paywall because we recognized right from the start that this could be a big story. We didn't realize quite the extent of it. I don't think anyone did, but we knew it would be an important major crisis and that we felt it our obligation to make all the content free.
Go ahead, please.
No, I was just going to say, this is something that's totally in our wheelhouse. We have an infectious disease reporter, Helen Branswell, who's covered these sorts of outbreaks, not anything like this, but she's covered, everything from swine flu to SARS to Ebola to Zika for the last 20 years. And she's been gearing up for this moment. We had a piece she did last October. She went to Geneva to do a piece on Mike Ryan, the quote, fireman of global health at the WHO. And he was talking about crisis management for outbreaks and Ebola and so forth. We wrote the story. It got attention. But look at it now. Mike Ryan is in the middle, in the thick of this. And so I think we've been well positioned. And I have to say that this may sound promotional and hyperbolic, but I would say if you had to read one reporter in the world covering this, one byline, it would be Helen Branswell, because she's been meticulous and authoritative in writing about this story. And she's not someone who's out there looking for attention. She just wants the facts out in a rigorous, authoritative way.
It seems to me like we're we're in a pretty unprecedented moment. You know, I'm 50 and I've never quite seen anything like this. This reminds me a little bit of sort of being in middle school and still thinking the Soviets might nuke us, right? Kids are being sent home from – I mean, it plays out differently, but kids are being sent home from college. You know, a ton of people are telecommuting. Other people are freezing in place. Some people are working but kind of dreading it. Something changed this week. What for you and when your staff, what would you guys define as the tipping point?
I think every one of us must have a tipping point where we think about what changed. And I'll tell you, my tipping point was – I did a panel at Harvard on Friday evening with Helen and with a couple other experts about the coronavirus. Right before this panel started, they came to us and Harvard announced no more big events. So we knew as we went on stage that this was going to be probably the last forum at Harvard for a long time. And then we were talking through this on stage, and one of the professors at Harvard said, this will be the worst outbreak in a half century. And that got my attention. But the real tipping point for me was I went out for a drink with my colleagues, a few of my colleagues after the event, and Helen Branswell. And Helen turned to us and said, what are you going to do when you're down staff at STAT because of the coronavirus? And she said it not in a, like, scary way, but just as a matter-of-fact way. And it hit me that, oh, my, this is going to touch us in a way that, you know, you try to think, oh, it won't be me. We're reporting on it. We have some distance. But when she said matter-of-factly, are you prepared with your staff, I realized this is going to touch or could potentially touch everyone.
Who this week officially called it a pandemic, I guess a day after CNN did, but who has a little bit more sway in these things, explain to listeners what that means.
It means that it's more about the spread. As far as I know, it's more about the spread than about the severity of it. It means that it's touched like pretty much the entire world. And it's a reflective of where it can be felt. It's not limited to one geographic area. And I don't know how much that designation really changes anything, but it certainly signals that this is touching the whole world and people better prepare.
Your reporters, you know, are tapped into public health experts and sources, you know, at universities, federal agencies, international organizations, all across the nation, all across the world. I've been hearing playing out on our programs, on NPR, in the newspapers, on the alerts you see. There's been a lot of cancellations, right? Colleges and the NBA and a lot of concerts, Coachella, you know, the world will go on. I'm seeing an interesting tension over whether to cancel schools. Here in New York City, where I live, the mayor, Bill de Blasio, has essentially said, you know, schools serve a public good. Parents have to work. Not all of them can afford care. Not all of them can get care. Some caregivers can't get in anymore because of their own issues at home. And it also provides food for over 100,000 homeless children in this city. In terms of the disease and the public, greater public good, are those arguments compelling in the face of arguments that we're trying to shut down social interactions to the extent we can?
David, I think part of the complicating factor here in having these discussions is we don't really know. I mean, we've said that young people are not as susceptible and they'll probably be okay. But we also know that they can spread it. We also know that we want to be careful and not put anyone at risk. So you can hear valid arguments either way. You can hear arguments of saying, like, I could just see families and parents, anxious parents, not wanting to send their kids out of the house. And the problem here is I don't think there's a clear answer for any of this. I think one expert may say close the schools. One may say don't close the schools. And you can argue it either way. And that's what's confounding about this whole thing. At every step, there's different directions you could go, and no one really knows the answer.
you've been talking to folks about this for a while. To what extent did people see something like this coming?
You mean before this? Before this,
before coronavirus became thing, before we had heard of Wuhan in this context in China, before we learned about the way in which this kind of stuff spread, in your field, to what extent were people saying, hey, pandemics may be coming, disease spreads internationally, travel is international, trade is international, our world is international in much greater, much more connected way? To what extent did people see something like this coming?
I think a lot of people saw it. I just tweeted out a video from the science writer Carl Zimmer, who several years ago was speaking about what could happen. I dusted off an interview I did 2 years ago with Bill Gates where we were talking about pandemics, and it was clearly a prescient interview. I mean, it wasn't just to me. He said this in the past for years. He's warned us. But hearing what he said – he warned of a pandemic, and he had just met the month before with President Trump. And he said, I suggested to Trump that they invest in technology and pandemic protection steps. And he said a small investment would go a long way. But he also said governments tend not to react in advance. Like, until something happens, they're not going to have the wherewithal necessarily to invest or make the funding. But it seemed like, I wish everyone could have seen that video of Bill Gates 2 years ago and taken it seriously.
Very briefly, before we take our first break, are you saying then that basically the government, not only was the government not ready for this, but it was clear the government wasn't ready for this?
I think it was clear the government wasn't ready for it. Certainly if you ask Bill Gates, I certainly think he would say that. I think probably past presidents weren't sufficiently ready for it, but I think under this administration, they've certainly cut many of the science advisors and made cuts that have made us more susceptible.
We're talking about how coronavirus changed the world this week. Coming up, we'll be joined by two leading Washington journalists to talk about politics and policy and give a little greater texture to what's happening there. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. Contagion is no longer the stuff of Hollywood blockbusters or a few week long scare. We're talking about this week's mass disruption nationally and globally due to COVID-19 or the coronavirus. Staying with us throughout the hour is Rick Burke. He's the co-founder and executive editor of STAT, a news site devoted to medicine and health. I also want to bring in two more voices to the conversation to help us understand how the virus is shaping politics and policymaking. Tolu Olorunipa is White House reporter for The Washington Post and an analyst on CNN. Tolu, welcome back.
Hi, David. Good to be here.
We also have with us Charlotte Alter. She's national correspondent at Time Magazine covering the 2020 election and the author of a new book, The One We've Been Waiting For, How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. Charlotte, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I want to play for you guys a couple of clips. President Trump leads our nation's federal government, and that is where one tends to look during times of crisis. On Wednesday night, seeking in some ways to assuage the nation, President Trump addressed it from the Oval Office. Here's part of what he had to say.
From the beginning of time, nations and people have faced unforeseen challenges, including large-scale and very dangerous health threats. This is the way it always was and always will be. It only matters how you respond, and we are responding with great speed and professionalism.
Now, Tolu, you cover the White House. Before we get to the great speed and professionalism part, my recollection is the White House had to correct three of the president's assertions in that, call it, 11-minute address. Can you remind us what had to be corrected?
Yeah, this was not a shining moment for the president or the presidency. The president said that not only would he be banning people coming from Europe to the United States, but he also said he would be banning cargo. That was not part of what he signed. That was not something the White House had vetted. It was not something that was part of the policy. And the White House immediately walked it back, saying that only people would not cargo would be banned from Europe. And the president did not make clear that American citizens who are in Europe would not be banned from coming back. That was something the White House had to clarify, that if you were an American citizen, if you had a green card, if you had immediate family in the country and you were in Europe and you wanted to come back, you could. The president didn't say that. It caused pandemonium in airports across Europe as people were rushing, trying to get back before the deadline. The president also said that insurers would be covering all testing and treatment for coronavirus. The insurance industry had to push back on that, saying, yes, they would give free testing, but they were not committing to free coverage because we know the cost of coverage and cost of treatment for a coronavirus could be very high, and the insurance industry had not committed to that. So the president had to walk back a lot of his claims, and it was very clear that his 11-minute statement, which was aimed at calming the nation, did not do that. We saw the largest stock market drop the following day since 1987, right after the president's statement, and it was clear that many people, including the financial industry, were spooked by what the president said, and it was a sign that things were going to get worse.
Let's underscore what you just said, that Tolu, you know, the greatest market drop in 33 years, more than a generation. You know, it's important to remind people the stock market isn't the economy, but it sure can reflect some of the faith that we have in it. You know, that caller that we played a clip from at the very beginning of the show asked about her husband, saying, you know, that her husband's, he's 65, his savings, his retirement savings have been depleted by the market drop. You know, the one piece of advice we hear from financial analysts is don't remove your money from the 401k if you can help it at the market's bottom. I wanted to go now to what happened the next day. Let's hear from Dr. Anthony Fauci on Trump's claims of great speed and professionalism. Fauci is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and he testified before the House Oversight Committee yesterday. Great speed? He said no. Adequate? Nope. Failing? At the moment, yes. And at the top of the mark, of these remarks, you'll hear Fauci referring to the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention about testing for coronavirus.
The fact is, the way the system was set up is that the public health component that Dr. Redfield was talking about was a system where you put it out there in the public and a physician asks for it and you get it. The idea of anybody getting it easily, the way people in other countries are doing it, we're not set up for that. Do I think we should be? Yes, but we're not.
Charlotte Alter, you heard from Rick Burke a few minutes ago on this show saying that it was evident from people promoting concerns about pandemic and the importance of preparedness that the government just simply wouldn't swing into action until it realized it had to, that people just don't tend to do rainy day things, take care of this like you take an umbrella from home just to hope to ward off the prospect of rain, right? Why is it that America seems to have had trouble reacting to this to a greater degree than countries like, let's say, South Korea, which also had to swing into action but seems to have contained things and seems to have many more tests for people available in a number of countries in Europe and other places affected by it, but nonetheless seeming able to spring into action to deal with it better?
Well, I think there's a couple aspects of this. There's the social aspect, which is just that, you know, Americans are very individualistic. Americans are very sort of think of themselves as hardy and rugged. And I think for several weeks or even a month or two, there were a lot of Americans, including the president, who were dismissing this as just a bad flu, you know, something that wasn't much worse than a cold or a flu, and it's no big deal if you get it. And certainly we know now that that's not the case, particularly for older people and people with underlying health conditions. But I also think the message from the top has been a message of, like I said, the president himself, you know, until fairly recently was kind of downplaying the risks here. And I think that it's very hard for people to spring into action and take radical action, like, for example, canceling the NBA season or like canceling Broadway shows. It's or even just, you know, on an individual level, staying in your homes and trying not to see people who might be vulnerable and trying to, you know, social distance from friends and family, it's hard for people to make those radical life changes if they don't feel like it's a true emergency. And people often don't feel like it's a true emergency until the president says it is.
I just want to say, related to what Charlotte said about social distancing, Trump, in his speech barely mentioned social distancing, which is the best weapon against the disease. I mean, it's the best way to stop a virus from spreading. And you didn't hear that message sharply from the president. And he also neglected to say something else that's very important that others have said, like Scott Gottlieb, the former FDA commissioner, who says the U.S. needs to create a surge capacity in hospitals. Elective procedures should be canceled. Hospitals should try to have as few patients being treated as they can. And he said virtually nothing about hospital preparation.
Tolu, I want to get at that point that Rick's making in some ways as well, a question of presidential leadership. You know, a president needs to be able to convey assurance that to citizens that he's in some ways leading an enormous infrastructure that will take this on competently and capably. And that has to be done both rhetorically and in terms of the policy, right? It does seem as though, as Rick said, that he's not affirming the things need to be done here. And there's a real question about whether his focus simply on the question of preventing people from flying to this country from other countries affected by it is avoiding the question of what's already here and how this virus is spread and the effects it can have, even if the United States was put in an enormous Ziploc bag and nobody was ever allowed in and out again.
Yeah, the president has made a focus on immigration on so many different issues. He's sort of said so many of the ills of the country are because of foreigners, because of immigrants, because of foreign nation states, whether it's trade, whether it's terrorism, whether it's crime. And he sees this same issue through the lens of immigration. Even though this virus is already in the country, it's already been spreading, the president sees, you know, this travel ban against Europe as a you know, panacea, even though many health experts have said it's not going to stop the spread of this, that he should have focused much more on what could be done within the walls of the country to make sure that this doesn't continue to spread, whether it's social distancing, whether it's ramping up the hospital capabilities to take in what's likely to be an increasing number of patients who are stricken with this illness. And the fact that the president is focusing on immigration, is focusing on attacking his enemies, is, you know, even though part of his speech was, you know, saying that we should not have partisanship, today he's blaming former President Obama. He's talking about sleepy Joe Biden, using nicknames for his political rivals. So there is this disjointed messaging between the president and the public health officials who say we need an all hands on deck approach. We need to focus on stopping the spread of this virus within the country and not so much of a focus on trying to ban planes from coming from other countries.
Rick Burke, we have here from a listener, Michael Hansen, posting on our Facebook page. He asks, why has the president been saying for weeks we have enough tests for anyone who wants one, when Dr. Fauci and every state health authority has repeatedly admitted America does not have and not perform enough tests? Americans have received contradictory messages for weeks now. It seems like the lies and lack of competent response to what's making people more anxious than even the danger of actually catching the virus. And I might say to listeners who may not recall this, Rick Burke was for many years one of the leading political reporters and editors of the New York Times, for the country. Rick, when you're thinking about this both through your public health hat and through your political prism, how do you look at that?
Well, I think your listener has a very good point, and I wish I had an answer for that because I can't get into the president's head. What I would say is, you know, as you said, I've been around a while. I've covered every president in some form since Reagan. And the thing about Oval Office addresses particularly, this should be presidency 101. I mean, it's like you go in front of the country, your advisors write a pretty straightforward speech, reassuring the nation without politics, without – this is the moment for a president, and it shouldn't be that hard to do. And I can't think of any other time when there was a presidential Oval Office address that people were tearing apart like this and doing postmortems quite in this way. And that's very concerning.
Charlotte Alter, you know, I'm imagining you're not getting out on the hustings as much as you had been until recently. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, both top candidates have canceled or postponed their events for the foreseeable future. So, I'm grounded
side.
For now.
You're grounded.
On the Democratic side. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, but what is your sense of what people are looking for, voters and I guess non-voters alike, from the White House, from the administration, from Congress? What do people expect from their federal government?
Well, I think one of the unique political one of the interesting political aspects of this situation is that this virus, unlike every other major crisis of the Trump administration, which seems to be happening, you know, every other week, this virus doesn't care what your party is, you know. So we're already seeing breakdowns in public opinion in terms of, you know, Democrats seem to be more concerned about the virus. Republicans seem to be less concerned, seem to be buying into some of the Fox News talking points about how it's not that bad or that it's being blown out of proportion. But regardless of what people believe, this virus is coming, and it, you know, the biology doesn't care about your political beliefs. So I think that that's one of the reasons why this is a unique challenge for the president, because he can't tweet it away. He's trying now to blame it on Democrats, but you know, it's not really something that can be blamed on Democrats. And even if he does successfully cast the blame on somebody else, that doesn't change the fact that people are getting sick and, you know, likely will overwhelm our hospitals. And, you know, we unfortunately are very likely to have deaths because of this. So, you know, I think that what people are looking for from their president is a sense of a steady hand on the wheel. And that's what both Sanders and Biden tried to project this week when they both addressed the nation about coronavirus. And what's also been interesting about the two of them is that they've kind of, you know, muted some of their criticism of each other for the time being. I'm sure that we'll see it at the debate on Sunday night. I'm sure, you know, they have real mm-hmm. political differences and they will be highlighted, but they've kind of turned down the campaigning for a second to focus on uniting the country and criticizing Trump's response.
And we'll be talking a little bit more about the campaign after the break. You know, it strikes me, it's interesting, you see a number of people coming to the fore to really try to offer an alternate sense of leadership and of where policy should go. Some of them former Trump administration officials. Scott Gottlieb, I believe, was head of the FDA under President Trump. Tom Bossert was a Homeland Security advisor under President Trump. And both of them have called for really dramatic efforts and much greater leadership from Washington. And yet you've seen some folks in the president's party I guess Senator Inhofe of Oklahoma, who's himself very much in the at-risk category, Tolu. He's in his 80s, James Inhofe, basically saying, I'll shake anyone's hand. I'm not going to be daunted by this. I'm not going to be sent back. The idea of sort of owning the libs through not fearing this virus. I'm hardier than that. And yet we've seen the president himself has come into contact, it turns out, the press secretary to the president of Brazil, tested positive for coronavirus, being quarantined down in Brazil. Well, just days ago, he was photographed standing next to the president of the United States in Mar-a-Lago. Tolu, so far, I haven't heard that Mar-a-Lago is being swiped down. We haven't heard that the president himself has even been tested, much less, you know, out of an abundance of caution, which is sort of the phrase of the day, sequestering himself in any way. Tell me a little bit about what the president's responsibilities are here and what actions are actually being taken.
Yeah, we've seen very disparate responses, even within the administration, even among Republicans, about how they respond to this virus. President Trump has said he's going to continue to shake hands, that he's not going to allow his daily life as a politician to change. We've seen some Republicans take that stance. We've even seen some Republicans say that this is all being overblown, that this is some kind of hoax, that this is something being used to take down President Trump by Democrats. And then we've seen some Republicans decide to self-isolate after coming into contact with some of the same people that President Trump has come into contact with. We've seen some decide to get tested based on their contacts with people who were symptomatic or people who had tested positive. The White House and President Trump have not followed that standard. They have said that the president does not feel any symptoms. The president has said for weeks that this is being overblown, that he does not think that this is something that should require us to change our daily lives. He's been sort of dragged kicking and screaming even to make the kind of address that he did on Wednesday about trying to advise people to listen to the public health experts, to take precautions, to be safe with the way that they conduct their daily lives. So we have seen a lot of contradiction within the administration and among the president's allies about what should be done in the face of this outbreak. And it's clear that President Trump does not want this to have a negative impact on his reelection. So for that reason, he has been trying to tell people it's not that bad and that there's no reason for concern. But it is clear that this is starting to panic a lot of people, the fact that there are so many different messages coming from different voices.
And the president also being influenced by the echo chamber he gets from much of Fox News, despite its the network's chief's pledge to provide an important public service on coronavirus by functioning as a resource for all Americans. We're a resource here. We're going to continue to discuss this week in the news how the coronavirus shaped and twisted it all. Next up, we will talk more about the 2020 presidential race. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. I'm here with who I think are just the right guests to help us make sense of an intense week. We have Rick Burke. He's executive editor of Stat. Tolu Olorunipa. He's White House reporter for The Washington Post. And as well with us this week, Charlotte Alter. She's national correspondent for Time and also has a new book, The Ones We've Been Waiting For, How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. I'd like to play a clip of a rare moment of spontaneous accountability in Washington. I'm not sure, Charlotte, if this particular leader falls exactly within the generational cohort, but let's find out. Yesterday during a hearing, Representative Katie Porter, a California Democrat, convinced a top health official to commit to the federal government paying for coronavirus testing for all Americans needing it. Convinced or maybe badgered, whatever it was, Porter did so over the course of several minutes by adding up the total cost of each test on a whiteboard. It was $1,331 in her accounting. And she read aloud federal regulations that said the CDC was authorized to waive the cost. At first, CDC Director Robert Redfield said it'd take a while to figure out how to operationalize such a move. Here's how that exchange concluded.
Our intent is to make sure every American gets the care and treatment they need at this time of this major epidemic, and I'm currently working with HHS to see how to best operationalize it.
Dr. Redfield, you don't need to do any work to operationalize. You need to make a commitment to the American people so they come in to get tested. You can operationalize the payment structure tomorrow.
I think you're an excellent questioner, so my answer is yes.
Excellent. Everybody in America hear that. You are eligible to go get tested for coronavirus and have that covered regardless of insurance.
Charlotte, I'm going to come to you in a moment to ask you about the nature of what we just saw there in terms of the politics and the leadership there. But first, I want to start on the policy there. Rick Burke, how unusual is it to have that kind of that interplay actually lead to something? And also, how convinced are you that that's going to actually be enacted in federal policy?
I'm not confident at all. And what I would say that sort of the overriding thing I'm seeing in all of this that's going on is this should not be a political time in Washington or for the country. And I remember after 9/11, I was a political reporter, and it was the hardest time to be a political reporter because no one would want to challenge anyone else about 9/11. We were all in this together, Republicans, Democrats. And here you have hearings and a situation now where there's so much politics, and I think it's coming obviously from the top that, I mean, people like Biden and Sanders shouldn't be in a position where they're sort of criticizing the president's performance. We should all be in this together.
Charlotte, let's talk a little bit about the moment there. First off, does Porter fit into your rubric?
So not quite. I mean, my book is
she's a little on the upper end, right?
Millennials. Yeah, she's not quite a millennial, but she does, you know, she does kind of represent this new crop of leaders who are coming to Washington with like with very new attitudes about how politics should work and creating viral moments, which is very much, you know, part of what I unpack in this book.
So Porter basically does this exchange. You write about AOC, who also does these very fact-driven kind of confrontations with the various federal officials she's doing oversight on. What makes them different and what may make them effective if they prove to be so in this age, in this moment?
So one of the things that's kind of interesting is that, you know, right after Watergate, a new generation of new members of Congress came into Capitol Hill. And it was right around then that you started to see live televised hearings, right, where it would just be these long videos of various votes and various hearings and testimony. Now we're seeing a shift towards these viral moments, these moments that are almost designed to go viral in order to make a political point. And, you know, one of the things that I learned about AOC as I covered her in this book was the extent to which these are often very clearly thought out in advance. I mean, I saw notes in AOC's office that were just like literally word for word, a pencil rendering of one of how this questioning would go. And it seems like, you know, it's very clear that Representative Porter prepared this really well. She said that she even gave the CDC a heads up that she was going to be asking about this, you know, asking them to prepare an answer. And so it's about creating moments of accountability that then are easily digestible enough that they can go viral in a way that ordinary people can understand them.
We're seeing new developments even as we're broadcasting. The markets back up at the start of the day from deep declines that we referred to earlier, but not nearly back up to cover all of those losses. The Boston Marathon has been at minimum postponed to September. The PGA Masters tournament has been put off. A lot of things still playing out and a lot of things still in play. I want to pick up a little bit about what we've been talking about and think about leadership and about how this affects the presidential race. Charlotte, you know, you cover that. It seems as though the former Vice President Joe Biden has emerged in a strong position. I want to play a clip of him speaking a little bit to the moment as well. He spoke yesterday in Wilmington, Delaware, his home state, about the president's response to the coronavirus. And here's what he had to say.
Protecting the health and safety of the American people is the most important job of any president. And unfortunately, this virus laid bare the severe shortcomings of the current administration.
We also heard yesterday from Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. He spoke from his hometown of Burlington, Vermont.
Unfortunately, in this time of international crisis, it is clear to me, at least, that we have an administration that is largely incompetent and whose incompetence and recklessness have threatened the lives of many, many people in our country.
In his address, Senator Sanders tied the pandemic to his signature policy plank, a Medicare for all. Tolu Olorunipa, how much is what we're seeing playing out in front of us, how much are our concerns and our anxieties likely to help lift the popularity of that proposal? I think it's you know, notably under 50% in terms of popularity in the nation as a whole. How likely is that to lift things up?
Well, one thing has been very, very interesting to watch is how even the Trump administration has started to embrace some of these Democratic ideas of universal health care, not completely, but in this very narrow issue concerning coronavirus. We've seen the president and his administration, including Dr. Redfield at the CDC, say, yes, we are going to provide free coverage universally to anyone, whether or not they have insurance. That is a microcosm of what Bernie Sanders and some of his followers have called for. We've also seen the administration say that they are backing this idea of paid sick leave. This is something Democrats have pushed for on the presidential stage and in Congress for quite a while. There has been resistance from the Trump administration. But in this instance in which we do not want as a country to have sick people going to work and spreading this virus to other people, the administration is getting on board with the idea of a paid sick leave federal program. That's something that we haven't seen before. So we have seen this virus really bridge some of the political divide and have even the Trump administration and Republicans get on board with things like paid sick leave, universal coverage. Even earlier today, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said that he wanted to present the idea of a suspension on student loan payments to help millennials. That's something Bernie Sanders and Democrats have called for. They've called for something much more expansive, including eliminating that debt. But even the idea of Republicans getting on board with suspending student loan payments to help millennials is a sign that this virus is starting to bridge some of these political divides and allowing some of these ideas that Democrats have pushed for a while to gain some traction, even on the Republican side of the aisle, where they hadn't been able to have any kind of traction in the past. So it's really interesting to see that. We'll have to wait and see whether or not there's a long-lasting impact, whether or not things like Medicare for All receive much more support among the public beyond this virus. But there is a sense that Democrats are showing how some of their policy ideas can be useful in a virus, in a potential epidemic like this. And Republicans, for the most part, are starting to get on board.
It's been interesting to see Elizabeth Warren, even after she ducked out of the race, is still putting forward policy proposals. She still seems to be saying she has a plan for things. And I guess you mentioned student loan forgiveness. She had been touting that in recent days as well. In that talk that Bernie Sanders gave, he also said, our country is at a severe disadvantage compared to every other major country on earth because we do not guarantee health care to all people as a right. And as we speak, some 87 million Americans are either uninsured or underinsured. When you are uninsured or underinsured, you hesitate about getting the medical care you need because you cannot afford to get that medical care. One of our listeners on Twitter writes, what are the states that declined and fought against the Medicaid expansion doing to prepare for coronavirus? I believe these states will end up overwhelmed like Iran. So Rick Burke, it sounds as though there is some support for extending government coverage, essentially having the government pay for a lot of Medicare medical coverage that isn't being cared for at the moment. Is that important right now? Or is that something just as a way of signifying that the government is doing something even in the face of something it can't quite control?
There are a lot of important steps that are going to have to be taken. It's really hard to know sort of what the next five steps should be, except to say this is something that's going to touch every person in this country, and we're going to see hospitals, overflowing. We're going to see people with certainly this drives home their own personal health and medical concerns in a way that we've never seen before. And I think that's got to have some kind of political effect about what the government should do, what the state should do, what the federal government should do. And it's hard to know where the pressures are going to be. But I think people are going to feel like something has to be done to relieve my anxiety and my concerns about, and my fears about my own health.
Rick, does this sort of in some ways sap the ability of Bernie Sanders to keep campaigning in any meaningful way? I mean, it would seem to be in some countries, you would think there would be calls for national unity just between parties. Given that the Democrats are in the midst of an election, or primary selection, I should say, although one that seems to be knitted up by former Vice President Biden, does this clear crisis drain the idea of conflict from the Democratic race?
I think Sanders has to be very careful. He risks looking unseemly in playing politics at a time like this. And so, yes, this is a tricky thing for any politician right now. And I think Biden has to be careful as well.
Charlotte, you covered those two candidates. How are particularly the Bernie devotees reacting to this moment? There's been strong, at least online, you certainly see a lot of people essentially trying to stave off the idea that they have to rally behind anybody except their chosen candidate. Is that different now?
So I think that Rick is absolutely right. I mean, I'm certainly seeing and hearing from a lot of Sanders supporters who basically feel like, you know, they've been advocating for all of these policies like Medicare for All and student loan forgiveness and paid family leave. And it's the answer has always been no, 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 we can't do it. And then suddenly when faced with a crisis like this, it turns out the federal government is able to do all these things. And there is, you know, there is money available to inject into the economy. And, you know, they when faced with a crisis, they can actually pull levers of government to help with some of these problems. And I think in the Sanders movement, there is a sense of, you know, well, this is like we've been in crisis for a while. They, you know, working families have been in crisis for a while, they argue. You know, it's just that now the rest of the country feels like they're in crisis. So suddenly there are all these, you know, policies that are being considered and funding that's available. I do think that Sanders himself is in a tough position here because Biden has always been running a unity race. Biden has always been running a campaign that's very much about let's come together as a Democratic Party and resist Trump. And Sanders' campaign has always been a little bit more about reforming the Democratic Party and drawing sharp contrasts between him and more moderate Democrats. And I think that one of the things that this crisis is making clear is that the moderate, more establishment Democrats that the Sanders movement is so critical of actually would have done a pretty good job in this particular situation and, you know, certainly wouldn't have fumbled. Certainly, it seems likely, probably wouldn't have fumbled it in the way that the Trump administration did. So that takes some of the sharpness out of his argument.
We're going to let that be the last word that you've been hearing from Charlotte Alter. She's national correspondent for Time covering 2020 and author of The Ones We've Been Waiting For. Thanks so much, Charlotte.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've also been joined by Tolu Olorunipa, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks so much, Tolu.
Thank you.
And we so appreciate Rick Burke being here this hour. He's co-founder and executive editor of STAT, a publication that covers medicine and health. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you, David.
You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Folks, we thank our staff all the time in these credits. I want to take special note this week. Like so many other journalists, our team has been working epic hours to cover the pandemic and the social and political fallout. Like many employers, NPR and WBUR have taken major steps to protect their health for their sake and for that of their communities. Still, some folks have to come in to get the show out. So I wanted to give a special thanks to those whose names you're about to hear. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Melissa Egan, Eileen Amata, Brittany Knotts, Stefano Katsonis, Wes Martin, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Grace Tatter, Adam Waller, and Sydney Wertheim. We all get help from Liam Knox, Carolyn Love, and Bradley Noble. You rely on people like them to get you the news and information you need, the news and information you can rely upon them. Let's appreciate them, along with people in public health, people in public safety, first responders, and others who serve you through these trying times. We also sure appreciate you for lending us your ears. And for the love of everything holy, please wash your hands. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.